Welcome back to another sci-fi episode where finances and psychology collide. During the government shutdown, I wasn't able to teach a class that we had on the schedule for quite some time. It was on Money Talks, Building Financial Intimacy with Honesty and Transparency. So I thought I'd go ahead and bring the Cliff Notes before we even aired or had the live class for this that will now have to be rescheduled into 2026. But even so, I'm really excited about the material for you today because it will examine how we think, feel, and behave with money as it pertains to our relationships with our spouses. And there's so much in that. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a spouse. It could be a long-term type of committed relationship where perhaps you are moving towards the direction of marriage and you may even need some premarital financial counseling, or maybe you've been married for a while and you're still looking for some ideas on how to talk about money or even become more financially intimate. So that's what this episode and potentially one or two more parts after this one, just to get through the entire thing. I'll talk a little bit about what intimacy is. So I did look up a couple of definitions. The first one is the Merriam-Webster definition, the state of being intimate. Or another word for that, which I really like, is familiarity. When people think of intimacy, a lot of times they're thinking of physical intimacy. But when I'm giving you these intimacy definitions, I'm doing this intentionally and strategically so that you can start thinking of intimacy a little differently. Familiarity. There's another one, something of a personal or private nature. So what I always tell clients is when you are financially intimate with someone, you are sharing details of your financial personal life that you wouldn't just share with anybody else. Now, it's one thing to have a group of girlfriends together and talk about your overspending habits and things like that. But then it's another thing to actually go through your statements and rebalance your portfolio from year to year and get into the weeds when it comes to net worth or debt load and things of that nature. Those aren't the things you're necessarily going to be sharing with your girlfriend, because a lot of times folks do not want to share those details because they feel like they're going to be judged anyway. That was Merriam-Webster. Now we have Cambridge. Their definition of intimacy is a situation in which you have a close friendship. Isn't that nice? Wouldn't it be great if we thought of our spouses as our friends? A lot of times that's something that could build on that intimacy. And we treat them as our friend rather than our enemies. So here's another point that Cambridge made in their definition. Things that are said or done only by people who have a close relationship with each other. So as you heard in intimacy definitions between Merriam-Webster and Cambridge, there's personal, private nature items, there's familiarity, there's friendship, and relationship. So all of those are great terms to really define what intimacy is. And I have a slide with a couple who the male partner is hugging the female partner from behind. And that is an intimate hug. You wouldn't necessarily hug your pastor that way or expect your pastor to hug you that way or somebody else, right? That is a type of hug that is just for that spouse. It implies a closeness, a familiarity, a private nature, and a friendship and a bond that only you two hold, unless you're at a Coldplay concert. If I could just throw in that was hilarious. I will also say I do have a juvenile brain. And when you think of intimacy, sometimes it's kind of funny when you look back at what your first impression of intimacy was. So again, I have a juvenile brain, and when I was younger, we had some Bible lessons in Sunday school, and we got to the book of Ruth, and it was between Boaz and Ruth, and there was a passage where Boaz knew Ruth, where in the verse it said, and he knew her. And I remember going to my parents and asking, what does this mean? I innocently asked. And of course, you know, my parents getting a little red face and like, well, that meant they had intimate relations with each other. And, you know, 8-year-old girl doesn't know what that means, but we all know what that means. And I hope you're getting the same kind of chuckle that I got from a friend that I tried try this out on. So there are many forms of intimacy, and we have many ways of saying it. And cross-culturally, we have several ways of defining intimacy. But because I am from the American culture, and this is a podcast is primarily for this culture, intimacy, and with Merriam-Webster and Cambridge being close enough to that culture, it is those terms that we just discussed. But let's talk about the different forms of intimacy. There's physical intimacy, which, of course, this podcast is not that type of podcast, so I can't get into what physical intimacy is, but you're old enough to know what that is. Think about Ruth and Boaz. Then you have emotional intimacy, and that is where you are actually sharing those deepest parts of yourself about what you hope for, what your expectations are. If you're having a bad day, the very first person that you would want to call, those are all things that are tied to emotional intimacy. And I hope that your spouse is one of those folks that you would be emotionally intimate with. Because after all, being a seasoned clinician and knowing about affairs and extramarital affairs, physical intimacy or the physical affair did not occur before the emotional intimacy in many of those instances. So this is a great reminder to guard your heart. And then there is mental intimacy. And that's where you're just sharing so many of those things that you know about, that you're passionate about, that you care about. Intellectual intimacy is another way to put that. And then there is spiritual intimacy. And talking about those things that are really important to you in regards to that domain as well. I've kind of flipped over a couple of those intimacy forms, but if only you could sense and understand all those different neurochemicals that are being generated through intimacy, no matter what form it is. And yes, it does occur within financial intimacy. Now, some of you listening, you might be thinking, oh, this sounds great, and I wish I had a spouse or a committed relationship where we could become more financially intimate. So I'm just going to go ahead and turn this off right now because I don't want to get my hopes up, or this isn't something that I would be able to attain. Let me just encourage you to listen to the entire episode before you make that choice, because you are not the only one that is struggling with that. So many folks that I see are not communicating about their finances, and there is a lack of intimacy amongst my clientele. So again, you are not the only one. You are not alone, but listen to the remainder so that you can get some ideas and maybe even be validated with what you're hearing as well, so that you don't give up too easily. Now, here's one last preface before I jump into the topic of financial intimacy. I want you to know that we just said there are several forms of intimacy. And usually people are thinking physical intimacy, but we've just covered several forms. So I wanted to remind you of that before I say this. Financial intimacy is not just something to be experienced with your spouse. Financial intimacy should also be reserved for your children. It used to be that parents would dare not share the family finances with their kids. It doesn't pertain to them. They're not old enough to understand. But here's my stance on that. How else are your children going to receive the financial information and education that they need? They're not getting it in middle school. They may or may not get some financial literacy training in high school. It depends on the actual school. It depends on the state. It depends on the curriculum. It depends on several different factors. So I'll share an example. My husband and I were rebalancing our portfolio not too long ago. And my oldest daughter, who is 16, overheard what our net worth was because I got excited about it. We had grown in the past year. I mean, obviously, you want to see that growth year after year, but it was exciting to see a particular number jump exponentially. And so, you know, we were just kind of high-fiving each other, and I said the number out loud, and my daughter comes in. She said, "What? Through this government shutdown, you had us pinch pennies and prioritize what we're spending our money on, but you have that in your account." So I, instead of telling her to mind her business and walk away, I invited her into the discussion. And I'm not saying that I deserve a pat on the back because of this. I'm just encouraging you as parents that there is room to create financial intimacy with your children. And by the way, you can listen to the episodes on this podcast of the book reviews that I've done for Personal Finance for Teens 101. And if you are a Team Redstone member, you can listen to the podcast and then give me a call and tell me that you've listened to that episode. And I will happily give you a copy of that book as long as supplies last, 256-876-6299. And the same with the talk about money, a book review for young adults. So that's a way to build financial intimacy with your children, is to give them and impart upon them that information. So back to my daughter. So I invited her into the conversation and told her it was a teachable moment. And so I highlighted for her, even though you heard this number, only this amount is actually available to us now. And this is liquidatable cash. This is something that we have access to. This area is something that we could also access, but it could possibly take several days to actually get that. And we don't necessarily want to touch that because it's doing a job for us in the markets. And then I talked about that huge portion, which is our retirement, and said, we will not even be able to touch this until we're 59 and a half unless we want to be penalized and all that kind of stuff. So that was a teachable moment, and it was educational for her. And it was something for her to get excited about as well, and kind of putting that information that she's heard us talk about before, like, now I get it. Now I understand what true net worth is. It's not just my cell phone that I have available to me. It's not just my car. It's all of these things included. So make sure that you are including your child in age-appropriate financial discussions. There's nothing wrong with that. So let's get into the couple's financial intimacy. There was a survey completed by Western Southern Financial Group. And what they did was they surveyed 1,000 Americans about their spending habits and financial goals. Now, what is not clear to me is as to whether or not this population that they surveyed were their existing clients, because there's something that could be said about that. If you are engaged in a firm's financial counseling with a certified financial planner, et cetera, that's a different caliber of clientele that you're surveying. But I'll get to that in a moment and why I'm saying that. But they surveyed 1,000 people, 80% were married, and 20% were divorced. So I'm going to look at this from the bottom up with you. So here's what they said. These are financial topics that couples delay discussing until after marriage. So the first thing is that 18% of folks surveyed did not discuss their salary until after they were married. So what does that tell us? 82% did. So yeah, that's a no-brainer, right? And usually before we are agreeing to marry somebody, we kind of want to know their earnings potential. You know, what are you bringing into this relationship? And I know that sounds horrible to say out loud, but let's just agree that those are the things that we think about because we have our own financial goals. And even if they're not financial goals, we have goals in general. And is this person going to help us achieve our goals, or is this person going to block our goals? So yeah, salary is something that most people are talking about before they get married. So they also found that 21% of married Americans have never discussed debt with their spouse. And more than one in four, which was 27% that they found, waited until after marriage to address debt. That is dangerous. So wait, what, Olivia? So these people are willing to talk about how much cash they're bringing in, but not about whether they want to get into the habit of spending cash or credit? So yeah, I'm with you. It's dumbfounding. In addition, nearly one-third, 28% of married Americans admitted to hiding significant purchases or debt from their spouse. And you know, the way to get around that is to ask each other to look at each other's credit reports before you get married. Their full financial report card is available to you if you ask for it. I think it's a wonderful idea. You've probably heard me say that on a different episode in any one of these episodes, that asking your spouse to see that credit report before you even tie the knot is a very healthy thing, and it does not imply trust issues. If anything, it implies that you are very invested emotionally, physically, spiritually, financially into this relationship, that these are the things that I want to know that are going on before I fully commit. And that is a good thing. Another 40% said they would end a relationship due to financial dishonesty. Oh, that is sobering. Okay, so we've covered two of the findings so far, that 18% of folks waited until after marriage to discuss their salary. It's kind of hard to believe. Boy, that's interesting. Then you had 27%, which is, again, one in four, or roughly, who did not talk about debt at all until after marriage. Boy, what a shocker that will be for some of those folks. And then you had 32% who didn't talk about spending habits until after marriage. And then 36% for both savings goals and strategies on bill paying until after marriage. Now, there are six more categories that are nearly half and half, where half discussed it prior to marriage and then half did not discuss it until after marriage. Let me make sure I said that correctly. Half discussed it before marriage and the other half waited to discuss it until after marriage. Last will and testament, that's estate planning. That's not shocking to me because a lot of folks seem to be fearful of that for some reason. But they didn't talk about that. They didn't talk about investments or buying property together. That one is shocking for me because usually people are talking about the 2.5 kids with a white picket fence, implying that it's a yard that you own, right? With being so home ownership or property. Then you have joint checking account. Are we going to compile our money or are we going to keep it separate? Only 41% of folks talked about that before marriage. And then here are the big ones. 54% delayed talking about retirement until after marriage. And 56% delayed talking about life insurance until after marriage. So the big one, and we're going to talk about this one often, it's going to kind of pop up throughout this episode and the next episode about retirement savings. Such a big issue amongst couples when it comes to lack of communication. So I like to bring you statistics. I like to bring you surveys and information that actually has teeth so that you can actually see what is going on with these couples, not just around you, but in America as a whole. So I'm going to go into this one study briefly, and then I'll break it up into different episodes. But I'm going to be talking at length about Fidelity's 2024 Couples and Money study. This is their eighth study since it was first published in 2007. I couldn't find one for 2025 yet. Usually that research will have to occur and be compiled and then released later, so that's probably why. But they have looked at 1,794 couples or 3,588 individuals aged 18 and older in a married or long-term committed relationship. So that previous study that I was talking about that was with that financial group, that was 1,000 folks that were surveyed, 80% that were married and 20% that had been divorced, recalling what they talked about before marriage and after marriage. But this is a different kind of study. And just to kind of tantalize your senses to come back for the information that I'm going to go over, they're going to be calling out, hey, this many couples said that they do this, but actually when we compiled the results, they were really doing this. It's really fascinating. So I want you to stay tuned to that. So here's something that's interesting. We're going to talk about financial intimacy, and we're going to talk about what keeps us from communicating, what keeps us from building financial intimacy. And the things that I've jotted down just for this class so that I could be prepared is fear, embarrassment, or they simply just don't know how to start the conversation. But here's the bigger one that I see in the session over and over and over again. I will never be like you. And that is the number one ribbing that people are giving each other over and over and over again. And it keeps communication from occurring. Is they're constantly judging each other or sizing each other up and saying, oh, well, you want me to be like you, but I will never be like you. And that is true because we were so uniquely created. We have different temperaments. We have different upbringings. We have different experiences. We have different things biologically, psychosocially, everything combined. We are just not going to be the same. So we're not going to approach the same financial crisis, or even if it's not a crisis, the same financial topic in the same manner. And let me go ahead and say that that is a good thing. And I want you to start reframing that and all of those differences as a good thing. And so what these couples do is they get caught up in generalities, believing that one style of money management is better than the other, or implying that their partner does it best and that they'll never measure up. So again, they're just believing that there's just one style of money management, and that's not true. So I thought of a way, how could I drive this home to the audience to really get you to reframe that and start thinking of it? So let's start thinking about money management like a pie. We have Thanksgiving coming up. We have Christmas coming up. You know, we got pecan pie, apple pie, chocolate pie, my personal favorite, and sweet potato pie, just to name four, because I'm kind of going into the different temperaments and consistently through research and what has been presented regarding temperament, it's usually four different styles. So you can go back and listen to season one, episode one on financial personalities. I'm just going to do a little name drop here on some of these. But let's say, for example, you're a pecan pie. And so you're a short-term strategist. You know, you're the type of person that really enjoys those short-term investments. Your strengths are that you're research-driven, you're flexible, you're cautious, you're a wealth builder, but your challenges or your vulnerabilities are that you only have a short-term focus. Not only, but primarily have a short-term focus. You experience a lot of FOMO, fear of missing out, and even FOBO, fear of better offer or fear of better investment, phobia, right? Or you're over-analytical, you're commitment phobe, and maybe for those who are having a hard time committing to marriage, maybe that's you. And then you're also risk averse. So that, let's call you a pecan pie. And then you have an apple pie that is your confident money manager. And I tied that one to apple pie because my husband is a confident money manager and he loves apple pie. And his strengths are that he's goal-driven, he likes a detailed budget, he's a long-term thinker, he's also a wealth builder, and he's that millionaire next door. And you would never know it because he doesn't show it. And that's a good thing. But his challenges and his vulnerabilities are that he is so independent. Sometimes he forgets to pull other people in and let them know what's going on. So a lot of times I'll have to ask him, I'll have to remind him, hey, you didn't show me those numbers. Can I go back and see those numbers so that we have more of an educated and intelligent conversation about what we're talking about? And he's highly overanalytical. And then you have someone like me that loves chocolate pie, and we're more like value-based planners. We are retirement-driven. We're charitable. We're long-term thinkers, but we're relationship builders, not necessarily wealth builders. We tend to be the Mother Teresa's next door, but our challenges or our vulnerabilities are that we make emotional-based decisions. And we can often become financially enmeshed with family members or extended family members if we're not careful. And we might have a hard time setting financial boundaries. And then lastly, there's sweet potato pie, where that is the laid back balancer, where their strengths are that they are balance driven, they're calculated, they're carpe diem, baby, because tomorrow may never come. And so if you were to observe a laid back balancer from afar, you would think they do not have their money together whatsoever, but some might surprise you. But they tend to be charitable, but that also comes with some challenges as well and some vulnerabilities. They tend to be list averse, not risk averse, but they lack organizational skills many times. They're usually all heart when it comes to decision making. And sometimes that leads to delayed decision making about their finances. So why am I talking about pie when it comes to this? And this is how I'm going to close out this first part of the financial intimacy series. Well, I've mentioned pecan pie, apple pie, chocolate pie, sweet potato pie. They're all sweet. They're all nice. They're all good. Now, you may have a favorite. Maybe you don't like pecans and you wouldn't say that that's a good pie, but it's still sweet. So it's the same thing with how we deal with our spouses or our committed relationships where we know we're going to be getting married soon. A lot of times we would say, hey, why can't you be more like me? Or I can't be more like you. Maybe think of it from a pie perspective. Each one of you has a very specific set of ingredients, but each one is collectively delicious and good and sweet. And so there are going to be some things that you don't, maybe you like the congealed stuff of the pecan pie, but then would go out and pick out all the pecans. I have a cousin like that. That is the favorite pie, but spends a lot of time just picking everything off the top so that she can enjoy the actual pie. So that's how money management is between us. We are going to be different, but we all bring sweet ingredients to the table. And this image of a pie can also give you or lead you to a mindset of abundance over scarcity. So if we think of pie, we think of, okay, so I just got a slice of that pie, and my cousin over here got a slice, my aunt got a slice, and this person over here got a slice. Oh my goodness, the pie is going really fast. I need to make sure that I get enough pie to satisfy what I need. So that's another way of looking at it is, okay, do I look at now that pie that is almost gone as like, this is the very last pie that will ever be made on the face of the earth, which is a scarcity mindset? Or do you work from an abundance mindset? Well, hey, there's going to be more coming out of the oven soon. So there's plenty to go around. So that's another way of looking at money. How do you approach money? Do you approach money with fear out of a mindset of scarcity, or do you approach money with an attitude of plenty or a mindset of abundance? So again, these financial beliefs that we have, these experiences that we've had, it's not that they're all good or all bad. They are simply influenced by these different ingredients, which ultimately lead to different behaviors. So when you're having these financial squabbles that are keeping you from financial intimacy, maybe that's a different way to look at it. I'm now looking at you as a pie that I wouldn't necessarily enjoy, but you have some ingredients that I could definitely use, and I would like to see how you make your pie. And let me show you how I make my pie. So everyone gets a piece of the pie. It's a wonderful thing. Flexibility is key. So join me again in the next episode. We'll go into that Fidelity 2024 research study, and hopefully you'll gather some more information to ultimately increase your financial intimacy. And remember to rate and review us wherever you listen.